And we need to be focusing on. And the next speaker is Kathy Falvo, and she is a pediatrician. And Kathy has worn many hats, and one of the most recent hats she's wearing is she's the Physicians for Social Responsibility representative to the UN and has just been elected as president of the International Society of Doctors for the Environment, and that's why she's going to be talking about the environmental aspect of urban health. And Kathy, what's the one favorite thing you like, apart from hanging out with us here in this room?
That's a tough one. What I have lately taken up, again, is playing the bassoon, which for me is great joy. My family is ready to divorce, but that's too bad for them. They can just go do something else.
You can buy them earplugs for Christmas.
They tell me it's not sufficient. Okay. Nothing to disclose, first thing. I actually have to change my talk a little as I go because some of the things I've said we're planning to say have been said already. Hopefully a little bit of, I'll say in a different way. And one of the things about all these discussions is that hearing things in different ways, all of a sudden, one way it's said connects for you to be usable information, even though you've heard it before, in other words. At any rate, environmental threats to urban health in the urban environment as opposed to rural or suburban, short and long-term nature of these threats, and some ways to avoid or minimize the environmental threats. So we start off with one of the really big problems you already heard about is the lack of water and sanitation. In some sense, that may be the biggest problem, particularly for developing countries where urbanization is very rapid and where the number of people going to urban areas are those who are marginalized and are going to end up living in sort of informal communities, what we, growing up, were called slums. The terminology changes. Informal communities may sound better, but it's slums. Okay. Air pollution is a huge problem after not having water and places to poop. And it comes from a whole variety of sources. Probably the main one all over is, or two actually, is what we're burning for fuel for power, or fuel for cooking, and motor vehicles. And that is true worldwide, doesn't matter where you are. And these are just some pictures. This one is on Lake Ontario, on the Canadian side. Very pristine upper-class community, and you have this messy, messy plant spewing forth soot like it's going out of style because they're burning coal. The picture's too dark, but there's coal all over the place about to be burned for power. One of the results of motor vehicles is injury, although in urban areas, the injury from motor vehicles tends to be more mortality and morbidity of pedestrians rather than the occupants of the vehicles. The vehicles get crunched, fender benders. They may end up being unusable, but the people in them will have some injuries, but probably not so bad, because one of the things about urban areas, no matter how hard you try, you cannot go that fast. Fires is a huge problem. House fires from either the cooking source, depending upon where you are in the world, or people sitting in bed and falling asleep with a cigarette, either on the couch or in the bed, and setting off fires. Poor equipment for heating, which then explodes. We tend not to pay attention, even though we should, to things like our Christmas scene down here, which is a disaster waiting to happen. A live Christmas tree, which is drying out right next to the lovely fireplace, that when you get close up, does not have a screen in front of it. But along, what's also been mentioned, so we have the fender benders, we have fires, we have a lot of interpersonal violence, and guns are available in almost the entire world, in urban and rural areas. They get there in different ways, but they get there. And you've already heard the discussion about increased tension, increased depression that happens to people, particularly poor people, when they move from rural to urban areas. And in the world's economy now, they're even more desperate because there is pretty much no place in the world that has a secure job market, even for the lowest end of people, to earn something. And so people get desperate. Crime goes up, murders go up, whether they're intentional. Murders go up because of anger more than otherwise, and then the unintentional ones when you're just going out to try and get some money and being. And then the other problem, which is actually in all areas and is from different causes, but is poisons of one sort or another. In rural areas, it's a lot of pesticides and herbicides and things like that. In industrial areas, you have a whole bunch of poisons that are used for different things that get thrown into water, get thrown out. And in households, you have all sorts of things you use, including pesticides in the household, rat poison that kids can get into, all the things we use for cleaning. So those are all problems that increase as places get more crowded, because gets harder and harder to actually keep controls. In the U.S., we talk about putting locks on all the cabinet doors in the kitchen that are low, where you keep your household cleaning things. When you're living in an 8x10 room, 6 people, that's not an option for the most part. I mean, it takes a really well-organized family to do things like that. Another problem, which we haven't discussed actually in cities, is noise. And some of the common sources are sirens from fire trucks, ambulances, the police cars. This is true all over. Airplanes going, crowds, and now what's becoming more and more popular all over is helicopter transport, including things like the healthcare services, which improves mortality and morbidity outcomes, but increases noise unbelievably all over. So helicopters are used for, you know, transport of patients quite routinely in many, many places now, including developing countries. And crowds have not changed over time. But then we have some other. Those are sort of the well-defined things over time. Now, one of the things, if you're working in terms of environmental hazards, you need to look and see what is actually in where you're working, because it changes considerably from place to place. So, as an example, in the United States, injury, primarily motor vehicles, is the fifth leading cause of mortality overall. It is the leading cause of mortality in 1 to 44-year-olds. On the other hand, in New York City, the only thing in motor vehicles that's of note is pedestrian injuries in terms of mortality. Injury is still fairly high, but it never gets up to be the leading cause of death at any age group in New York City. It hovers around fifth for a lot of things, but then you get into fires, drownings, and poisoning take the lead. So you need to know what's going on where you are to try and figure out what kind of interventions might be appropriate and useful. Okay? Now, there's some other less well-defined things that go on in terms of environmental hazards to health. These chemicals polluting food, air, and water are fairly universal, unless you're living on a farm where you control the vegetables you eat, as opposed to if you're agribusiness, what you're exporting for the urban areas. To get fresh, unpolluted food, fresh, what should be fresh, unpolluted food to urban areas is a fairly expensive process. And so it doesn't happen, you know, the whole organic movement is still fairly small, and the price, at least in the U.S., is considerably higher than otherwise, although it is expanding. But chemicals from everything, including our fuel sources, coal-burning power plants, spew forth mercury, among other things, which ends up in the fish we eat. But they all foul food, air, and water. And all of that, as you know, knows no political boundaries. So the coal plants in the Middle West have destroyed the lakes in the East. The mercury in our fish does not come from mercury dumped into the ocean. It comes from mercury floating through the air, primarily from coal-fired power plants, that blows into the oceans and then converts into organic mercury. Electromagnetic fields are one of the things that are on the horizon. They're being investigated in terms of what they do to health, and particularly all of these things in terms of what they do to the health of adults, certainly, all of us in the room, but of much greater interest is what all of this is doing to fetuses and young children. Okay, so in the long term, that's one of the really more interesting fields of study now, is when a pregnant woman is exposed to a whole slew of toxic things that are out there, including mercury and fluoride, PCBs, BPH, all of that stuff. Some of it causes direct fetal damage, which we measure as either central nervous system problems, congenital malformations, fetal death. But some of it causes genetic change, which may be more subtle, but will continue. The other thing that happens is the environment changes the whole, which genes that normally there anyhow will develop better or worse. And so we're changing the whole human, now that we have the human genome, we're changing the whole system in ways we know nothing about yet and are just starting to look into. And then the final thing is that all of these pollutants, the soot and dust that causes asthma and chronic pulmonary obstruction, many of them are also end up causing cancers and a variety of other chronic diseases. Anything that damages your lungs, which is everything irritating that you breathe, puts stress on your heart. The two systems run together, even though we talk about them separately. So there are a whole lot of those things to consider. So what are we going to do about this? So a lot of this you know, but this website is actually something I just came across, incidental to being at the UN for something else. The Cooper Hewitt Museum, which is the National Museum in the Smithsonian Institute of Design, it's in New York, has this ongoing project now of how to deal to get urban, these expanding urban areas, particularly the slum areas, to be habitable in middle class terms. How do you build affordable, reasonable, locally producible, which would be part of affordable housing? What kind of designs do you need? How do you get water? How do you deal with the issue Justin talked about of these plastic bags that are not sustainable? How do you get that water into households in containers that will actually purify it and be available? Okay, so there's that. All of this stuff you know, public transit, et cetera, these, I'm sorry, I left it home, but these are pictures of the front and back of a credit card-sized card that was developed by Mount Sinai, which is, we think about, you know, can we recycle this plastic or not, the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 numbers? Well, they looked at it in terms of urban health of which plastics do you want to avoid using because of their potential to leak toxins into the water or whatever's in them. And so the green side, 1, 2, 4, and 5, are better in terms of morbidity kinds of toxicity and leaching than 3, 5, and 7. Or 3, 6, and 7, sorry. So green is the better ones and blue is worse. And that's it. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Kathy. And I just wanted to say that it's really shocking that yesterday I was at this meeting and they were discussing as to how after the recent nuclear disaster in Japan, that nuclear material was found on school-age children in Tokyo, which is almost 200 miles away. So what does that tell you? It just adds on to what you said about, you know, the long-term effects and the short-term effects. And we really don't know as to what's happening. And the Agent Orange, which was used during the Vietnam War, was even found 15, 20 years later in the breast milk of women who were feeding their children. So this is really scary. And again, all that, you know, carries over to urban health.
Can I make a comment about what you just said?
Yeah.
I think in terms of Japan and their nuclear power plant explosion, there's no surprise to anyone who's followed this that it would end up in Tokyo, it would end up in Los Angeles, and it's probably ending up in New York, because we know that when the Chinese were doing atmospheric testing of nuclear weapons, their radiation ended up in New York about 3 months later. So nobody's surprised, and that certainly early on we're looking. What it also was not a surprise, at least to me and some of us, was this information only got out from Japan because citizens got up in arms and had been doing their own testing. The government, until the citizens walked in with their own measuring devices and said, "You're lying," has been hiding everything. And that's, you know, sort of what goes on.
And just to add on to what you said, even the what happened at the World Trade Center, when they said that, oh yeah, it was safe for people to go back, and those of us living in New York, and now 10 years later, they just released a report. Those of you who are interested can go onto the New York State Department of Health, and it's just up. It's really scary as to, you know, what happened to people over 10 years. So we really have hard data. So again, that's the disconnect, I guess, with the actual evidence base and what the policies and the media and what the government wants us to listen. So with that being said, I would like to open up the panel for discussions, and those of you with questions, could you please introduce yourself, and if there's any one particular panelist you would like to direct the question to, or, you know, it needn't necessarily be a question, it could be a comment or something you want to share with the rest of us, and yes, could you please introduce yourself? Thank
Hi,
you so much.
My name is Vera Hunt, I'm a doctoral student at University of Maryland School of Nursing, and my question goes to the first presenter. You mentioned about the water, and I'm from Ghana, West Africa, and the sachet water, is it possible that people are probably selling some of the water that is not clean, that they're just going to their homes and just using their own water that's not filtered, and probably put it in these plastic bags and just going ahead and selling it? Because I had that fear when I went and I saw people drinking sachet water. That's the first thought that came into my mind.
Yes, so it's a great question. It's a great question that could be fully answered in a whole separate paper presentation, but the short answer is yes, there's a lot of quality control concerns there, because a lot of the sachet production is occurring in a gray market, and government's having a hard time regulating this phenomenon because it's something that just appeared on the scene just in the last 5 or 6 years and blew up really fast. And so in certain parts of Ghana, there are reports that less than 50% of the producers are actually registered with the government and people go for it. So, and there are a few papers out there about quality concerns, but again, the bias is towards negative findings, right? No one's going to test everything clean and publish that paper. So by and large, most of the sachet water is pretty good. because most of it is being given some additional form of filtration or UV. And what I may have neglected to say in my presentation is that that's municipal water coming out of city pipes. So that water's already been treated upstream. It's been chlorinated, whatever the residual chlorine that may still be in there, who knows. But generally, they're located in areas where there's stable water supplies, which is pumping out the water. So that's part of what makes the contradiction is that it's possible that because it's municipal water and it's usually getting additional treatment, that the poorest segments of the population might be drinking better quality water than everybody else. And that's why we see that possibility of that positive health outcome, which is overriding every other risk factor that people living in those types of slum communities would normally have for adverse health outcomes.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm
Joseph. I did not drink from the tap, not necessarily because the tap water is terrible everywhere, but because I don't have the acquired immunity that everybody locally has.
Yeah,
so
no, it wasn't a
true
question.
That's pretty
straightforward. I did the same thing when I was there. I had a well injected into the ground, but it was the tap water was for washing hands, and the sachet water was for cooking and drinking. That's
right. And that's how a lot of the city lives. I have drank a lot of the sachets. See what this is all about. I don't know anyone that's ever gotten ill or had an adverse. I've never even heard a story on the second or third hand of an adverse reaction or anything with sachet water. But if you try different brands around the city, there's variable quality and there are different types of chemical disinfection that are used in the sachets. And there's some that you taste that it's just awful. It tastes very chemically and metallic. And there are other ones that are produced by big corporate providers that are like the local equivalents of the Cokes and Pepsis that are producing millions of bags a year. And it tastes absolutely fine. It's almost the exact same thing that you're getting in the bottled water that you buy. It's one for 100 times the unit cost.
So my actual question from that was, in terms of the environmental problems, I definitely see that as being the biggest impact of using those sachet packets. Has the government, from what you've done or seen, has there been any movement toward using a different type of packet? Are there concerns about, different chemicals being in the water from being in the sachets? Like, I see that as one of the aspects coming from your research in terms of so many people are drinking this water. What are the impacts from just the actual production and just how it's, sitting in the packet?
Yeah, great question, and sorry to monopolize the So yes, the main concern in the city and what everyone gets upset about is the litter, because they're not refillable packages, they end up just everywhere. I mean, you can't go through a crowd, or at this point probably can't go to an urban place in Western Africa and not see them somewhere. They're just spreading. They originated in Nigeria and pretty much every country contiguous to Nigeria and Ghana. Government's moving very slowly on this, the way things are in the region, and one of the developments that they're pushing the producers toward is creating a biodegradable package, which seems like an obvious answer, and there have been a few prototypes of plastic wrappers that will degrade in about 90 days under certain conditions, and of course there's always caveats to that, which are, well, okay, 90-day degradation in a controlled condition. And that's a long enough time that these things go out to market very quickly, so they're not sitting in warehouses for months on end. So 90 days is sufficient, but that's in controlled conditions. What happens then when they're up on the heads of women in the market, being exposed to sunlight at 95 degrees day after day, or just sitting in marketplaces in a larger bag? So there are all these other caveats, and people are looking at primarily bacteriological quality when they do quality assessments, but things like
chemicals
and plastic leachates and things like that that are in the water and heavy metals and things like that. And we know that those are our major concerns in our drinking water here, but it's something that people know about there, but it's just off the radar as far as testing facilities. There aren't very many laboratories that can even do those kinds of tests in the first place, so it's very expensive and slow. So yes, those are all additional issues that are going to continue to be part of the problem, unless it's actually just banned completely, which has a precedent in sub-Saharan Africa. I think Tanzania had banned the sleeves many years ago because they were unable to control the quality of what was going in. It was a major, major quality control problem, more so than the plastic waste. Now there are parts of Dar es Salaam where they're having drinking water shortages and stuff like that. They're thinking of bringing it back. Something that came up in a work conference just about a month ago. So it's not going away, and the problems will continue to waterfall.
I just wanted to add something to it. India is a good example in terms of the bottled water. Came in very quickly, became very popular. One of the things which the government has done is that if you pull it a little tighter, it will crumble.
Yeah.
So they are plastic which are of a lower grade, if you will, but there is also a recycling of the empty bottles. So the message on the bottle is crush it after use. If you don't crush it, there is the problem of somebody refilling it. But when we think about refilling, it is not the health impact which is more important. What is more important is the equity impact. Let me give you a classic example. If I'm a rich person, I'm going to go and then get the bottle. Let's say it is unsanitary water, I drink it, I get a diarrheal problem. Think of the poor person. For the poor person, if that person is not drinking it out of the bottle, that person is still drinking it somewhere else. Without it. So the bottle is not a remedy. The bottle is simply a vehicle or a container in which that unsanitary water anyway is going to be consumed.
So are you saying that maybe there's potential for a monetary benefit to be connected to? I might have read too far into what you're saying, but I'm almost saying it kind of what we do here in terms of if you recycle, you get rid of that. Is that something that would make sense for sachets? If you bring in the packets for whatever, one CD, then that might be a potential thing for, because I know with like soda bottles, when you bring them in, you get some money back, like in time. So I'm thinking, is that something that could be done? Is that what's done in liquid?
Yes, so when I first came over here, which was about 29 years ago, I was really worried about the amount of material which goes to waste. To give you one example, is the newspaper. The newspaper comes in different forms. You get almost about, I would say about 55% to 60% of the value of the newspaper back when you take it to the people who buy it. And how does it reappear? It comes back as here we have brown bags. They are newspaper bags. So if you forgot to read the newspaper 3 years ago, you can read it now. It may be a collector's item. Every piece of it, Brazil is a classic example. You see this being bound, and people are being exposed to toxic things, but there is a sub-economy there, where even one piece of the metal, one piece of the plastic, gets recycled in some way or other. That way, when we look at it in the United States, we are way far behind in terms of how much waste which we create, which could be recycled. So yes, that certainly helps, whether it is the sachet or whether it is the... But coming to think about it, it has to be economically beneficial. How many of us, when it says that 5 cents, you can get it back, how many of us actually take it back to the grocery stand to get that 5 cents? I'll keep both my hands down.
But we don't need it.
Somebody needs it. That's what I'm saying. The economy is completely different because if they don't do that recycling, there's going to be a tremendous number of people who won't have bread that night.
Yeah, I think I saw somebody else's hand up before I take a question. I think I saw somebody else. Did you have your hand up? No? Okay, I think you, sir. And then you can, please. Introduce yourself. And
my name is Charles Penn. I'm a PhD candidate at Walden University. My question goes to in your research, did you find any country in both Asia or Africa who has been able to stabilize the rural urban growth in terms of developing similar quality environment in a rural area to halt that threat?
There is a wonderful paper by Matthews, which I referred to. I would give you the reference after this, because what he has done is categorize the countries. It is not something which we can say that the tide has been stemmed. It hasn't been stemmed. But what it's done is it has moved in terms of developing some equity in terms of rural and urban development. And in Bangladesh, which I showed you, unfortunately, in a 14 years time period, the rural development went on so well that the slum dwellers in Dhaka, to give an example, did not benefit any well. But careful control has helped in several nations. To give you some examples of that, I didn't note it down because I thought somebody might ask this question. In terms of the, if you look at it in terms of substantial urban exclusion, it is many countries, Chad, Ethiopia, Niger, Bangladesh, Haiti, Nepal, India, Indonesia, Pakistan, Philippines. That again is three different categories in terms of measuring the assets of each one of these population groups and then seeing how much variation. If you look at the marginalization of the urban poor, which is much better than the previous category which I mentioned, you have examples of Bolivia, Ghana, Zambia, Egypt, Honduras, Malawi, and it's a long list. I just selected a few of them. If you look at it in terms of minimal urban exclusion, which is where the movement could be, is you see it in Colombia, Vietnam, Dominican Republic. So yes, if the policies are there to create, what one does, and many of these urban planners will say, is that you create smaller cities to come in between the bigger cities and the mega cities and the rural areas, so that there's not this mass migration from there to there, but then you are actually creating concentric circles of places where people may choose to do. And there's an advantage to that. The advantage is people are not leaving their places and traveling 200 kilometers into a new place or 400 miles into a new place. They're traveling 30 miles or 30 kilometers into a new place. When they do that, there's a greater chance of them to go back. And so they have 1 foot in the rural area for the kinship and the support and all those, and they have that economic opportunity or modern medical care or whatever it is. But it is a fluid transition which goes in both directions. Whereas when they leave everything and then come into a new setting, they're likely to stay there. Because there's also that losing faith that they go back without what they came to earn in the urban age.
And if I just want to add to something you said, that in Hyderabad in India, well, a few years ago, the politicians spent so much of money developing the capital and the urban area that in the next, and it became the high-tech city like the Silicon Valley 2 of India after Bangalore. But the problem was because it was at the cost of shifting all the funds to the urban areas, and the rural areas suffered. So they suffered a tremendous defeat in the subsequent election. And so his successor, they again started putting money and having, you know, more, opening more rural health clinics and everything for the rural places in Andhra Pradesh. So again, this is an interesting, you know, the yin and the yang, the balance as to what happens. And I think it's, they really have to, that's when, is it like the politics triumphing over policy, or what do we do? Does anybody have any question? Yeah, can I give her a chance and then get to you? It's okay. Yes, please go ahead and introduce yourself. It's you, please.
Michelle Ashley, I'm a nurse with the Mountain. I will treat that for you. I have a question about the issues related to design. I think you started to kind of cover on it, we sort of ran out of time. That's going on in New York or a company. I was wondering if you could speak a little more to that.
Okay. One of the things about urban areas and suburban areas, but urban areas, depending on how they grow up, they're more or less healthy for people. There are whole big issues of, you know, how do you design it physically so that there's open space, as discussed by one of the Park Service speaker on the opening session. How do you make it so that people do not depend on cars to get around, that they can walk, they can bicycle, things like that, so that it's a more healthy place. One of the things that happens is inner cities have some of the worst air, but they don't create it. It's brought in. Okay, I live in Manhattan some of the year. my car, when it's there, it sits in the suburbs, because who needs a car in Manhattan? The air in Manhattan is terrible from traffic, which is all the suburban richer people, or should be richer people, coming into town with their cars because that's what they're used to doing. Even though they moan and groan about parking and traffic jams, which they create, but they ruin the air that I'm breathing routinely. Many cities, the center of the city is where poverty exists. The richer people move out to the suburbs where the air is cleaner and all of that stuff. And so you get these huge sort of environmental injustice things going on as well. The Cooper Hewitt Museum looked at this and got a grant, I can't remember from whom, to do a project asking architects to design things needed by urban poor communities to solve the problems that the communities defined. And they've got a whole series of them. It comes in book form. It's all on their website. So you can either look and go, what's going on in a place I'm interested in, or I'm interested in how you deal with clean water for drinking in places where there isn't running water at all. Or there's one, you know, pipe stand in the middle of the street, which may or may not be very clean anyhow. How do you design houses that people will be comfortable living in based on what they're used to living in, but that are healthier? And they've got a whole pile of things that are really sort of interesting. And it's one of the things we tend not to do, I hear a lot of people saying I'm a student of, is to think in terms, to get your students in whatever field, including public health, to sit and think about these problems that people who are out trying to make a living once they finish school. You know, the architects are not going to design houses for really poor people. They don't get paid to do that. But you can have your architect students do that as a project. And we don't do enough of that. But it has a lot of interesting things there, and it's all on the website, which is what I put up, and I can't remember, and I didn't print it out. But if you look, if you didn't get it written down, and you presumably this will be up on APHA available, but otherwise, if you look under Cooper Hewitt Museum, it's in there somewhere. But it's designed for the 90s.
Thank you. And just to add on to that, if you're interested, if you go onto the New York Academy of Medicine website, and there's a link to the Urban Health, so they have a lot of information too about designing and what Dr. Shankaran was talking about, you know, to have the hybrid between a mega city and a rural area. And I think you had a question? Yeah, I'll come to you. I think. Didn't you have your hand up earlier?
Yeah, I was just going to ask if.
Could you please introduce yourself?
Hi, my name is Kui, and I'm a fellow at the CDC. And I was just going to ask about whether some of the references from your presentation would be available for us.
Yeah. I think because this is tape, you can see that, but you know, most of my references are from the WHO, and they have, and then I think even you have your references up there, and actually I have a copy, so if you want, I could give you the references. So I think you had a question, and then I'll come to you.
And then I'm just going to say, the references to my things are all on the note part of the PowerPoint presentation.
Yes, ma'am.
I'm Heather Pace. So I just wanted to share an announcement that in December, the Journal of the American Public Health Association will be publishing a supplement on environmental justice and health disparities. And for those of you who have a passion for many of the topics that were discussed here, there will be 14 analytic essays in this supplement that will speak to things like physical infrastructure, psychosocial stress,
much for sharing that. Thank you. Yes.
I just wanted to speak to the recycling issue. They have actually started recycling in Akosombo. And Akosombo was built and designed after a model city here in the United States. So that's a whole different environment. And they sent their teachers to Norway to learn about recycling. So when they came back, they started recycling. But unfortunately, they changed the director, and this director is not buying into that recycling idea. So that has, you know, kind of brought it, you know, taken it out. But what they were going to do was to actually have recycling and also allow people living in Akosombo, you know, the town itself, to actually bring in, you know, like the sachets, the plastic bags, and those plastic containers or anything that they had, to bring it to the campus of Akosombo where the school is, to actually to be recycled. But unfortunately, the director.
Thank you for sharing.
Killed the idea.
So. Thank you so much. Does anybody else have any other questions or comments? So thank you so much for your comments.